It's Monday, August 14th, and this is The Takeaway.
When I think of torches, I want to think of the Statue of Liberty, and when I think of candlelight, I want to think of prayer vigils. And this was a parade of hatred and bigotry and racism and intolerance.
You pretend you're patriots. You are not patriots. You are dividers.
Tibet has been declared an unlawful assembly.
They want to destroy everything you care about. We're not going anywhere.
The counter-protesters at the high rate of speed knocking down the victims in its path. This is the woman who was so tragically killed. She was 32 years old.
I don't see a difference in her and, you know, someone who, you know, died in Iraq or somebody who died on 9/11. It was still a terrorist attack.
James Alex Fields, Jr., a road-raging terrorist.
I didn't know it was white supremacists. I thought it had something to do with Trump.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're glad to have you with us today. White supremacy, white nationalism, violence, and death in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend. The nation watched as uniformed, slogan-shouting white nationalist groups rallied in Emancipation Park near the university founded by Thomas Jefferson, and as armed militias in flak jackets carrying long guns stood by like paramilitaries.
One guy, you talked about how Africa for the black man, America for the white man, and that was sort of what they were aiming for. So a really, frankly, sort of warped play on a Marcus Garvey idea from the 19-teens and 1920s.
That's an eyewitness to the demonstrations in Charlottesville over the weekend who we'll talk to in just a moment. Counter-protests on Saturday turned violent, and then one man who was seen earlier lined up with white nationalist demonstrators and holding a shield allegedly sped his car into a crowd of people, injuring at least 19 people and killing 32-year-old Heather Heyer. James Alex Fields, an Ohio man described as a Nazi sympathizer, is in police custody and charged with second-degree murder. The Department of Justice has officially opened a civil rights investigation into that attack, and the president condemned racist groups and racial violence at the White House today, 2 days after declining to do so, and 2 days after a backlash engulfed the administration.
Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
Throughout this hour, we'll talk to people in and around Charlottesville reacting to the weekend and what it means as America thinks through another display of Confederate history, of racism and violence, and we'll hear voices from around the nation, including yours.
This is Cherie from Oakland, California. As a nation, everyone should be outraged, but of course, this is just more of the same disregard from the establishment.
My name is Iris. I'm from Woodcliffe Lake, New Jersey. We should respond with one voice that this kind of behavior will not be tolerated in the United States, and it needs to start with the president.
Your voice all this hour as we take stock of a violent weekend in Virginia. Aaron Frazier is a graduate of the University of Virginia in politics and African-American studies. She's also a 2017 Rhodes Scholar, and she was an eyewitness at the protests on Friday and Saturday in Charlottesville.
They would throw water bottles, and it was unclear what the water bottles were filled with until, you know, they hit the ground. Sometimes that was chemical gas. Sometimes it was pepper spray. Some people were hit by urine that was filling the water bottles as well.
What do you think the nation is missing in how we're viewing these protests, the counter demonstrations? What are we missing about the nature of white supremacy or the nature of these protests and what they mean?
Well, it's a few things. So one, for all of the talk about, you know, the alt-right demonstrators coming to Charlottesville with the intention of exercising their right to free speech and their right to assembly, they certainly came prepared to inflict real harm. And that's clear by the gear that they brought, right? They brought bottles filled with chemicals to throw at protesters. They came with helmets. They came with shields. You don't really see a whole lot of that on the counter-protesters side. Myself, I was raising a poster board that I had that had a Martin Luther King Jr. quote on it as cover over my head. So I think that's one thing that may be being overlooked. I think another thing that's overlooked is really on the side of the counter-protesters, there was so much camaraderie and so much community that was being built in that space. And so if people had extra earbuds or extra gloves or extra face masks, they were sharing, they were offering that up to the people who they were surrounded by, people who they'd never met before. You had people out on the streets handing out orange slices and cold bottles of water throughout the day. And it was really this level of community and the fact that we were in this together. And I think it's that spirit that I believe will be able to continue to fuel not just counter protests, but the everyday work of changing policies and practices that reinforce and recreate white supremacy.
There seems to be a debate about whether or not the violence that followed the demonstrations on Saturday was terrorism. There's been a tacit reluctance to call it terrorism, including from the White House. Does this language choice matter to you as somebody who was involved, as somebody who was there, whether the car crash and the death and the injuries that everyone saw is called domestic terrorism?
Oh, it absolutely matters. And the fact that people, leaders, are reluctant to, you know, call a spade and call a terrorist is shameful. If a Muslim American had ran a car into a crowd of people who were just walking down the street, it would have instantly been labeled a terrorist attack. And so the question becomes, can only non-white people be terrorists? Is it only people of color? Because this is homegrown terror. This is terror that's being reinforced in people's homes, that's not being, you know, challenged, or at least not challenged strongly enough within our schools, that is raising up this new generation, right? The people who were out in those streets were young. They were young people who were talking about Africa for the black man, America for the white man, and talking about the differences in the brain sizes between the races. So this is certainly something that is homegrown, and it wasn't grown back in the 20s or the 30s or the 40s or the 50s. It was grown, you know, in the 90s. It's being grown and passed on to their children today. And we have to do something to address that and stop it. And it has to start with calling it what it is.
Before I let you go, you mentioned that you protected yourself in the melee there with a poster with some quotes from Dr. Martin Luther King. What did your poster say?
The quote on it is, "We must accept finite disappointment, but never lose infinite hope."
What's the finite disappointment that you were talking about when you wrote that on the placard?
The violence and the utter inhumanity that was on display by the driver of that car, by people pelting rocks and throwing pepper spray into the streets. I think it's clear that that's disappointing. But the hope is always for tomorrow and always for what we can change in the future and what we can change for our children and our children's children. But that takes a profound sense of being able to stay the course and persevere through that finite disappointment.
Aaron Frazier, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Aaron Frazier is a graduate of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville and a 2017 Rhodes Scholar. One of the immediate issues that brought white nationalists to Charlottesville, Virginia, is the planned removal of the town statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Now, there are thousands of Confederate monuments all across the South, from statues to street names, and several cities have made moves recently to remove or at least relocate their monuments. On Saturday, after the violence in Charlottesville, the mayor of Lexington, Kentucky, said he's accelerating plans to relocate two Confederate monuments in his city if he can get the city council to go along. Mayor Jim Gray is here. Mayor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, Todd. Glad to be with you this morning. And your conversation just now with Aaron was moving and inspiring. Her comments were surely on point.
Right. So you listened to that conversation there, and now after the events in Charlottesville, Mayor, you've said that you're going to accelerate your plans to remove these couple of monuments from your city. Charlottesville didn't cause this. This has been an ongoing debate in your city. So why is it critical now?
Well, I'd planned on Tuesday of this week to announce the my recommendation to the city council that we relocate, we remove and relocate the two Confederate monuments. They are located today on really what amounts to sacred ground. They're located on an area called Cheapside, where slave auctions were held before the Civil War. It's one of the largest slave auction sites in America in the South. And these two Confederate monuments are there, and they're inappropriately today honoring Confederate men who fought to preserve slavery. And it's on the very ground that men and women and often children were sold into slavery. And that's just not right.
Mayor, I understand that a review board in your city had recommended this removal as far back as 2015. Why has it taken so long to get to this point? And do you think that it's the events in Charlottesville that are the final catalyst to get this removal going in Lexington?
Yeah, we listened to our citizens. There, as you can imagine, as we hear this today, there are many points of view on this issue. And we listened and we heard our citizens. We put together a plan. There's a long process here that we have to go through, and that includes our city council resolution and then a petition to what's called the Kentucky Military Heritage Commission, who has authority for these monuments to move them. Our plan is to petition, with the council's approval, to petition the Heritage Commission and ask for the authority then to move them.
Mayor, these are statues. They're symbols. They're important, but they're not the real important part of this debate and your actions here. What do you want the message to be to people in Kentucky and around the nation to moving these Confederate monuments out of a major city in the South and to another location?
There's no perfect time to speak out against hatred and violence. There's no perfect time. Standing up and speaking out is a responsibility of us, especially as elected officials, and not sitting back and relaxing in times like this. Now, these are American values that we're talking about, liberty and justice and freedom. It's so much about dealing with our history in a truthful way. And that's what this debate symbolizes in my view today. And you heard it from Aaron so well and so eloquently just now.
And I assume we're going to let you go, Mayor, but you expect to get significant pushback, yes?
Well, there's always pushback. What I've learned is that mayors in these decisions, we're on the razor's edge. We're on the front lines. But we're given these opportunities. They're, in many respects, they may be blessings because we're given these opportunities to really stand up for what America has believed in.
Jim Gray is the mayor of Lexington, Kentucky. Mayor, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
My name is Joe. I'm from Red Bluff, California. My father is the 94-year-old veteran of the D-Day invasion. He's still alive. He's in the home. He's probably not able to understand this news. He has Alzheimer's, but I know how he would feel about a Nazi uprising on American soil because he lost his buddies. He lost his buddies fighting the Nazis. We will not stand for this. We will not stand for a president who cannot unequivocally denounce it.
Your voice all this hour at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Well, let's stay on the scene now at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville because one of UVA's newest professors joins the faculty at a moment when his background has become particularly relevant. A.D. Carson was appointed the first professor of hip-hop at the University of Virginia this summer at a time when the city is struggling to communicate with its conservative suburban surroundings in Virginia. When Professor Carson was earning his PhD at Clemson University, he worked actively with Clemson students, with the faculty and the staff there, and with community members trying to raise awareness of historic and entrenched racism at Clemson. He did it in part using art, like hip-hop. And now, after this violent weekend in Charlottesville, he turns his attention to his new university town. I spoke with A.D. Carson. He's assistant professor of hip-hop at the University of Virginia, and we talked about his reaction to what's going on around him.
I mean, it's one thing to read about these things, you know, to research and to produce scholarship, to produce art and music. It's another thing entirely when you're standing in the midst of it all, in front of, you know, in front of the statue out on the streets, and the police are in riot gear, and you've got white supremacists with weapons and helmets on, and you're staring them in the face. I think that that makes it all the more real. It makes me realize that, well, this is where I moved. This is where we are currently. This is America.
And without a doubt, this is a pretty stark contrast, right, from anything you might talk about in the classroom with students or with community members to some pretty real life if you're out there on the protest line.
Yeah, and I think that, well, my approach in the classroom has always been to use the present moment, whatever might be going on. I mean, when I was in South Carolina, when the case of Michael Slager killing Walter Scott occurred, this was what was on the screen in front of the classroom. And my question was, what do we do? How do we engage with this particular story? How might we see one another differently or see ourselves differently because of this?
What about this latest event in the context of those other things that you've seen when you get into the classroom with your kids?
I mean, I arrived at Clemson the week that George Zimmerman was acquitted for killing Trayvon Martin. And from that point forward until now, you know, they're just, and this was part of my dissertation project, which was music, but also this historical context for folks to be able to understand that music. And so you see there's this timeline of these things that have been going on across the country. And as I've been here in Charlottesville, I've been working on a new project that's very similar in scope, but very particular to Charlottesville. And so it seems eerily familiar. I mean, but far more, I guess, it's raw and it has an immediacy that maybe I didn't have, because while there was Klan recruiting on campus at Clemson, we didn't have the Klan descend upon the campus. There weren't armed militia people who were there seemingly to harm people. So I think that the approach here is going to be different for me in the classroom, and that we're going to have conversations about it. But I think that, I mean, I need to take as much care as possible to sit with the conversation about not how this isn't us, but really about how this reflects who we are, and then what do we do with that?
Let me ask you a question from the news, Professor Carson. The president, after these events on Saturday, condemned hate on many sides. Those were his words. There was some cleanup afterward from an unnamed White House spokesperson. The vice president issued some stronger remarks on a trip to Columbia last night. But the president did not call out white supremacist groups or white nationalists or the Klan or Nazi sympathizers, as others in politics have done over the last 36 or 48 hours. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that it's not surprising. And also, it's not like Trump is some kind of historical anomaly. He's not the first president who has benefited from white supremacy or white nationalism or hate groups who are dead set on the extermination of certain people in this country. And maybe it's surprising to folks that that's the case. But I mean, again, if my work is like dealing with the ways that we conveniently forget or overlook history and historical context, then I think that it's important for us to look historically at the role of white supremacy and white supremacist groups in the so-called democracy that we're living in. And if we look at that, then maybe that can be instructive for us in dealing with the current administration and the ways that this not only has been strategic for him getting votes, but ways in which it's completely unsurprising that he wouldn't condemn these particular actions, or he would say something like, you know, on all sides, or whatever it is that he said.
Well, Professor A.D. Carson, you are an assistant professor of hip hop, of course. What music's on your mind?
Well, you know, I've actually been writing. That's been the outlet for me, is to write and to record, because I try to see my way through the circumstances that are going on through my pen and whatever might come out, especially in moments like this.
Well, I know I'm putting you on the spot here. I'm curious, and I wonder if you have anything that you've written over the last day or two that you would be willing to share.
Let me see if I can find something. Yeah, here we go. See, but freedom ain't free, neither am I, and no matter where I happen to be, blink of an eye and it's over. So that red, white, and blue and that little flag is the same thing a nigga might fear when he see that flash in the mirror or hear that siren that's likely to give a fit. Have him thinking this is it. It don't matter if he resist, he was living. And if existing and feeling, having a mind and a desire to engage as a person is still a crime, then it's that. These are facts that are plain, and I'm only saying it don't matter if you think it's a game, if they think you playing regardless. Just a part of the problem is that I'm me, not willing to take a knee, standing on 2 feet since I can. No matter what the approach, how I address it, consequences will be dire if I am seen as aggressive. So if I die, and it's from that line of thought, I said freedom ain't free, and this is kind of what it costs right here.
Standing on 2 feet, Professor A.D. Carson.
Word.
A.D. Carson is Assistant Professor of Hip Hop at the University of Virginia. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been sharing your reaction to the news out of Charlottesville and how you think our leaders and your fellow citizens should be responding.
Hi, this is Julie from Wilmington, Delaware. I think that the president needs to speak as harshly against white supremacists as he does against journalists. It's a sad statement that our president is tougher on journalists doing their jobs peacefully than he is on violent white supremacist racists.
Hi, this is Julie Harrell from Erie, Colorado. And no, I don't think we're talking about hate in America the right way, because we're not talking to each other about these things. We're talking about each other.
Hi, this is Cheryl. I live in Charlottesville. It's generally a positive, peaceful, and welcoming town. The white supremacists, Nazis, and fascists made it very ugly this weekend. As for Trump, he might as well have been marching with them.
Hi, Peter from Wyomissing. I think maybe we have to think that we've been a little way tolerant of bigoted and hate speech. When it's easier to be a Nazi in the U.S. than in Germany, we have not understood history. When we let these groups continue, we are not being vigilant.
My name is Betsy. I'm from Blairstown, New Jersey. We don't address even overt racism, much less institutional racism, adequately. I believe the first step is to acknowledge that all white adults, myself included, are complicit to varying degrees.
Hi, this is Kim Bessie, and I'm calling from Fall River, Massachusetts. In my opinion, I don't think either side has addressed the violence as well as they should. Obama did not condemn violence that erupted after each of the police shootings and the African Americans that were shot by police. Each incident happened and he just kind of moved past it. And I also believe that the media somewhat glorified the violence that erupted during the presidential campaign when it was directed at the conservatives. I think this is what Trump was referring to when he said from all sides.
This is Portia Scott calling you from Charleston, South Carolina. The rally was free speech. The violence was a crime. These two actions are not synonymous. This needs to be made very clear. It's very simple, and yet we are allowing this to become very complicated.
Hi, this is Richard. I'm calling from Congress, New York. My grandfather taught me a long, long time ago that a fist only gets you a fist. Ignore them as long as they are not causing any physical or property damage. We are a nation of sensible and intelligent, for the most part, people. Ignore them in the media and in person, and they will go away.
This is Amelia from Parkland. I think that the hate that's in America today is nothing new in our nation's history. As a nation, I think that we've relaxed and settled into the ideal that racism is no more because we've had an African-American president for 8 years. But this is not true. It's still there, but we've just pushed it under the rug and have chosen not to address it on a serious and national level. Unfortunately, it's going to take incidents like what happened in Virginia for people of this country to open their eyes and to decide that enough is enough.
Hi, my name is Laurie from Halifax, Mass. If you are willing to campaign and condemn, on the words, radical Islamic terrorists, then you should, as the President of the United States, be able to condemn and use the words white supremacists. Nothing less makes you complicit.
Your voice, and we always want your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. You can join the conversation, as always, on our Facebook page. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The violence in Charlottesville on Saturday was acute. It was one moment in time where protesters and counter-protesters attacked each other, and where a white nationalist allegedly drove his car into a crowd. But it brings to mind violence of a more chronic kind. And there's a long list of names that's familiar now in America. Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Philando Castile. These are just a few of the high-profile deaths of African-American males at the hands of law enforcement. But then there's the 2015 death of Sandra Bland. She was a 28-year-old woman found hanged in her jail cell after being arrested during a traffic stop in Texas. And the case, for some, illustrates long-hidden acts of police violence against women of color, not as often fatal, but underreported. Andrea Ritchie has been studying the roots of police violence against women of color for more than two decades. She's an attorney and author of the new book, Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color.
Often the studies are framed as gender neutral, but really the assumption is that we're only talking about men of color and black men specifically. And often the data exists where scientists or people who are analyzing it could compare the experiences, for instance, of black women against those of white women or women of other races. And people just don't actually bother to do the analysis.
So there's a lot of focus in your book, Andrea Ritchie, on girls of color. And you say here that the policing of women of color actually starts very early, actually starts when they are girls.
That's correct. And recently, there was a study that came out of Georgetown that talked about the adultification of black girls. In other words, that adults treat black girls as if they're sort of mini adults, starting at a very, very young age. So one of the first stories I learned about in studying this issue was of a 5-year-old girl who had been handcuffed in her school for essentially having a temper tantrum, which I'm almost certain, without scientifically studying this, that every 5-year-old has had at least once. But in her case, the response was that the police were called to her school. And when they saw that a 5-year-old was by that time sitting calmly in a chair, they still proceeded to put handcuffs on her, even though they were too big. They couldn't fit on her wrists. They had to put them around her upper arms because they were too big for her wrists. And I just, in that moment, I think that adultification is playing out in ways that are incomprehensible because someone is literally arresting a 5-year-old for assault when clearly they're behaving as any child would. But the perception is that they deserve the kind of punishment an adult would get in that situation. And so I feel like that study was really instructive in showing how the policing of black girls starts at such an early age and what the dynamics are that are informing that.
Well, I want to talk about a couple of cases with older children, not 5-year-olds, that you say are illustrative here. The case of Jerria Becton in Texas, a high school senior who was attending a graduation pool party in an enclave outside of Dallas. People will remember the video of Miss Becton in a bikini on the lawn outside of the pool where a uniformed police officer who was white grabbed her, slammed her to the ground, and then put his knee in the center of her back. And you really highlight this case as an illustration of something important.
So first of all, if you watch the entire video of the interaction, she was actually walking away when he tackled her. Yet in the papers that he filed in the lawsuit, he makes a significant argument about what a threat she was to him in that moment and how she was posing a threat to his ability to engage in the policing activities that he was engaged in as she was walking away. And as she was walking away, she called back to someone to call her mother. And that was what the officer perceived to be a threat. It's, again, this perception that black girls, no matter how young, no matter how small, no matter what they're doing, are perceived by police as a threat that must be met with the kind of force that we saw in that video. And then secondly, it was illustrative of the fact that, you know, the presence of black girls in public spaces is perceived as a threat. And that was what prompted the incident in the first place, that there were white adults who felt that there were just too many black children at a pool that they sort of expected to be white space. And that led to racist interactions and altercations, but then also a police response that presumed that the presence of black children there was a sign of disorder that had to be responded to.
Of course, you talk about the effects of policing and incarceration on women as well, not just on girls. And you talk about the case of Sandra Bland. It was a traffic stop. Sandra Bland pulled over, later on found dead in her jail cell, ruled a suicide. You point to this early in the book as a rallying point. You say in some ways, Sandra Bland came to stand for every black woman who's ever changed lanes without using a turn signal, expressed frustration at getting pulled over, or suffered depression. What did you mean by that?
Sandra Bland's case sometimes gets framed in the public discourse as if it's sort of an anomaly in that it was a traffic stop and it happened to catch a black woman instead of the usual sort of main target black men, and that it gets told as a story that's sort of an addendum or a little diversion from the main story, and then we return to the main story with the usual cast of characters. And Sandra Bland's story matters because Sandra matters, but it also matters because it's a story of so many black women who have experienced traffic stops, that her case is part of a larger pattern. And it's so much so part of a larger pattern that many black women saw it, recognized themselves in it, and really created space for a lot of black women to come forward, to talk about their experiences publicly, to rally around them, to demand attention to them as part of these larger conversations about racial profiling and police brutality.
Are women of color as likely to get pulled over in the first place as men of color, especially when compared to white people?
I would say that every study I've seen that disaggregates the data according to both gender and race has found near identical rates of racial disparity among stops of women as they find among stops of men.
Well, Andrea Ritchie, some of this script got flipped a few weeks ago in Minneapolis. Justine Damon was a white woman from Australia. People came out in the streets in Minneapolis to protest. How do you think the country and the media digested that story in light of the other police violence against women that you're talking about in this book?
I think there's been a lot of conversation about how little effort there was to dig up her past criminal history, to try and put the blame on her for what happened to her, for how little question there was that this was an improper shooting. And many law enforcement officers came out immediately to say that this was an improper shooting and that this was a tragedy. And for many of us, it was so painful to watch because it was such a different response to any time a black woman or girl is assaulted or killed by police officers. So obviously it was a tragedy and representative of some of the patterns I talk about in the book where, you know, women call for help and police officers perceive them as a threat and kill them as they did in Charlena Lyles' case. But as you can see, the difference there is that immediately the question was Charlena Lyles was framed and perceived by the public and the police in a very different way and blamed for her own death. So the contrast was really quite stark.
Well, Andrea Ritchie, your book seeks to change the conversation when it comes to black girls and black women and women of color and policing. Where do you think the conversation goes from here? How does the coverage have to change?
The hope is that it will shift the narrative such that we are looking at these issues through the lens of women's experiences as a matter of course, and that that is a normal part of the conversation, that central every time we talk about policing, that we're going to talk about the ways in which, for instance, Jeff Sessions ramping up the war on drugs, how that's going to affect women of color in ways that are similar and unique to them, or similar to the experiences of men and then unique to the experiences of women. And both of those things are going to be central in our conversation about the impacts of that policy decision and our response to it.
Andrea Ritchie is an attorney and an author. The new book is Invisible No More: Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Andrea Ritchie, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we've been hearing many voices out of Charlottesville today, and many, many of you have been giving us your voice as well.
President Obama would have made a trip to Charlottesville, Virginia. Trump, you might as well have just marched right along with him.
I don't think we're doing nearly enough to address the hate coming from the far right.
Stand up and do something, America. Stop blaming it on Trump.
Keep sending your reactions our way at 8778MYTAKE. You can always send a tweet at The Takeaway, or you can head on over to our Facebook page as well. As always, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. It's a huge part of what we do here on the show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state committed to acting quickly and decisively on corporate interests. Learn more about how Arkansas works for businesses at arkansasedc.com. And LegalZoom, working to help Americans take control of their families and assets with an estate planning kit, which includes an informational ebook and other resources. More information available at LegalZoom.com/prepare.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.